Welcome to Base by Base, the podcast of genomic discoveries. Today, we're diving into really a groundbreaking study. It tackles one of the toughest challenges in cancer treatment, this thing called tumor heterogeneity and, of course, drug resistance. Imagine trying to hit a target that's not just moving, but constantly changing shape. That's often what cancer therapy feels like, right? But what if? What if we could find a common vulnerability, something underlying all these diverse cancer cells, no matter their individual quirks? Our deep dive today looks at a really clever strategy. It kind of flips the script on how we usually think about developing cancer drugs. Instead of trying to directly block a known cancer driver, which often comes with nasty side effects, this research finds a hidden dependency. It's like finding this one single crucial thread, you know? And when you pull it, the whole fabric of these aggressive tumors just unravels. The approach, it's called synthetic dosage lethality, and it opens up a really exciting new path for treatment. Let's explore how they figured this out.
Yeah, absolutely. And today we really should celebrate the work of, a huge collaborative team. Researchers mainly from places like the University of Saskatchewan, Saarland University, and the Helmholtz Institutes. Their dedication has really pushed forward our understanding of these targetable weaknesses in cancers that make too much of a protein called PLK1.
Okay, let's unpack this then. The biggest hurdle, as you said, in cancer treatment is often this tumor heterogeneity. It means even inside one tumor, the cancer cells can be incredibly different from each other. Some survive treatment, develop resistance. It's like a mixed bag, making it super hard to wipe them all out with one shot.
Exactly. And this diversity, it's often fueled by something called chromosomal instability, or CIN. CIN is basically, it's errors happening when cells divide. They end up with the wrong number of chromosomes. This chaos actually helps the cancer cells evolve quickly and dodge therapies. And a key protein controlling this whole process is polo-like kinase 1, or PLK1.
PLK1.
Right.
I know it's involved in really critical stuff like kicking off cell division, building the machinery, the spindle that pulls chromosomes apart, making sure everything gets segregated correctly. Like you said, a conductor for the cell division orchestra.
Mm-hmm. And in loads of cancers, breast, colon, pancreatic, glioma, lung, prostate PLK1 levels are way up. They're overexpressed. The tumor cells actually boost PLK1 production to help them survive and grow like crazy, which kind of ironically also fuels the very CIN and heterogeneity that makes them so tough to treat.
Okay, so if PLK1 is such a big deal, such a major player, why not just block it directly? I mean, it sounds like the obvious thing to do.
You'd think so. It seems obvious, right? But despite decades of research, honestly, direct PLK1 inhibitors have had very, very limited success in the clinic. There are real challenges with getting inhibitors that only hit PLK1. They often affect similar proteins, leading to toxicity in normal cells, like in the nervous system. Plus, it can mess with other important cell processes, like how cells handle low oxygen, or even, unfortunately, promote angiogenesis, making new blood vessels that feed the tumor. It's problematic.
Okay, so direct inhibition is tricky. Lots of collateral damage. Given those problems, what's the alternative? What else are researchers looking at?
This is where this really smart idea of synthetic dosage lethality, or SDL, comes in. Think of it like this. Normally, maybe two genes work together fine. If you knock out one, a healthy cell might not care much. But in a cancer cell where one gene, like our PLK1, is already cranked way up, massively overexpressed, suddenly, hitting a second gene, one that's normally non-lethal to disrupt, becomes fatal specifically to that cancer cell. It's a vulnerability that only exists in that specific cancer context, a genetic Achilles heel, you could say. And the goal then is to find that second gene.
That's a really elegant idea, exploiting a weakness that only cancer cells have because of their existing abnormalities.
Right.
So how did these researchers actually hunt for these hidden vulnerabilities, these SDL partners for PLK1? Sounds like a huge search.
It was. They use a very systematic multi-platform approach, really thorough. First, they did an unbiased genome-wide screen using something called pooled short hairpin RNAs, or shRNAs. They used a special colon cancer cell line, HCT116, where they could actually switch on PLK1 overexpression whenever they wanted. This initial screen was like casting a giant net. It pulled in a big list, 960 potential SDL hits, a lot to sift through.
Why 960 candidates?
That's
it's a massive list. How on earth do you narrow that down? How do you find the real gems in there?
Right. So they had this really rigorous strategy to prioritize. They didn't just rely on the screen. They brought in patient data from the Cancer Genome Atlas, TCGA, looked across 33 different cancer types to see which of their candidates were also upregulated along with PLK1 in real patients. They also checked, were these hits more essential in cancer cell lines that naturally overexpress PLK1? And critically, they looked at patient outcomes prognosis. Did having low levels of the candidate gene combined with high PLK1 correlate with better survival? Things like that. They layered all this data, filtered it down, included some functionally relevant hits, eventually getting to a much more manageable list of 105 top candidates.
That's clever. Integrating the lab work with real-world patient data and survival stats. Okay, so 105 genes. What was the next step to really validate these, to be sure they were genuine SDL partners?
They moved into more realistic models, patient-derived xenograft or PDX breast cancer cells, specifically the HCI-010 model. This one naturally has high PLK1 levels, so it's much closer to a human tumor. And here they used CRISPR technology, both in vivo, so in live mice carrying the tumors using a pooled CRISPR screen, and also in vitro arrayed screens in the lab. These more focused CRISPR screens confirmed 65 of the SDL hits, and importantly, 10 of those showed up strongly in both the in vivo and in vitro tests. That overlap gives you more confidence.
65 validated hits, 10 overlapping, still a decent number. How did they then zero in on the absolute best ones, especially considering that tumor heterogeneity problem we talked about?
Right.
Different cells might have different weak spots.
This is where they use a really cutting-edge technique. It's pretty neat. It's called direct capture perturb-seq. This method let them look at the effects of knocking out each gene, not just on cell survival overall, but on gene expression and viability at the level of single individual cells. That's crucial, like you said, because of heterogeneity. Maybe knocking out gene X only kills some of the PLK1 high cells. Perturb-seq lets you see that fine detail. They did this in another breast cancer cell line, MCF7, which also naturally overexpresses PLK1. It gave them incredible resolution.
Single cell resolution.
Yeah.
That's powerful. So what popped out from that super detailed analysis? Was there a clear winner?
There was. Among the top hits from perturb-seq, which included genes like COB3, DPP9, and TJP3, one gene really stood out, IGF2-BP2. And what makes IGF2-BP2 so compelling is that it didn't just show up in the perturb-seq. It was identified across all three of their independent screening methods: the initial big hRNA screen, the in vivo CRISPR screen, and the single-cell perturb-seq. That kind of consistent validation across different platforms really points to it being important.
IGF2-BP2. Okay, so that's the star of the show. Once they nailed it down, what did they find out about what it actually does in the cancer cell? And how does targeting it hurt those cells?
Yeah, the findings here are really fascinating and show this kind of dual action mechanism. First off, they showed that getting rid of IGF2-BP2 significantly reduced the amount of PLK1 mRNA. And this makes perfect sense because IGF2-BP2 is known as an M6A reader protein. Think of M6A like a little sticky note on the RNA message. IGF2-BP2 binds to these notes on the PLK1 mRNA and stabilizes it, stops it from getting broken down. So no IGF2-BP2 means less stable PLK1 mRNA, which means less PLK1 protein. They also confirm this link in patient data, finding a strong positive correlation. Where PLK1 is high, IGF2-BP2 tends to be high too across many cancer types.
Okay, so hitting IGF2-BP2 dials down PLK1 levels. That's great. That's the intended effect. But you mentioned a dual mechanism. What's the other part?
Absolutely, because you have to ask, well, what else is IGF2-BP2 doing? And it turns out losing IGF2-BP2 also messes up the cell's energy production in a big way. Specifically, mitochondrial ATP production. It does this not just by lowering PLK1, but also by destabilizing the mRNAs of genes involved in oxidative phosphorylation, or AuxPHOS. That's the main engine for making ATP. They even found the specific RNA sequences, the binding sites that IGF2-BP2 recognizes on these AuxPHOS gene messages, so it's directly controlling their levels too.
Wow, so the double whammy then. You hit PLK1, a major cancer driver, and you cripple the cell's main power plants at the same time. That sounds incredibly effective. Is that combination why this approach seems so promising?
It really is. They did these mitochondrial stress tests and, yep, confirmed it. Cells lacking IGF2-BP2 had much lower metabolic activity, lower baseline energy production, lower maximum capacity. And this is super important because these PLK1 overexpressing cancer cells, they're often described as being addicted to high energy levels. They need tons of ATP to fuel their crazy rapid division. So hitting your energy supply like this is a major blow.
Okay, but the million-dollar question, is it specific? Does hitting IGF2-BP2 harm healthy cells too, or just the cancer cells? That's always the key challenge, right?
Totally. And that's a crucial piece of the puzzle they looked at. Encouragingly, they found that knocking down IGF-2 BP2 had minimal effect on the survival of non-cancerous healthy cells.
Right.
But it severely impacted malignant cells, like the aggressive MDA-MB231 breast cancer line. They also used 3D models, these tumor spheres, which are more like real tumors. Silencing IGF-2 BP2 significantly stopped colonies from forming and slowed down growth in these more complex models.
And did this hold up in animal models? Did it work in a living system?
Yes, it translated beautifully. First, they confirmed IGF-2 BP2 itself is way overexpressed in patient samples of various cancers, including triple-negative breast cancer, TNBC, which is notoriously hard to treat. Then, in mice with MDA-MB231 tumors, silencing IGF-2 BP2 strongly reduced tumor growth. And even more convincingly, they used those PDX models, the ones derived directly from patients. In models that had high PLK1 but low IGF-2 BP2 naturally, the tumors grew much, much slower. Their doubling time was longer. The growth curve was flatter. It directly supports that SDL relationship in a very clinically relevant setting.
That's really strong evidence. So did they manage to bridge the gap from genetics, silencing the gene, to pharmacology? Did they find a drug that could actually inhibit IGF-2 BP2?
They did, which is a huge step. The research group had actually previously identified the very first small molecule inhibitors targeting IGF-2 BP2. So in this study, they tested several of these compounds. One of them, called compound C4, showed the most promising drug-like properties.
Compound C4. Okay, so how did C4 perform? Did it act like the genetic knockout? Did it work in the animal models?
Yes, it did a remarkable job mimicking the genetic effects. Treating cells with C4 effectively suppressed the PLK1 overexpressing cancer cells. Pharmacologically, it looked decent in mice, had a reasonably long half-life, around 22 hours, and stayed in the bloodstream. And mechanistically, C4 treatment also tanked mitochondrial respiration and ATP production, just like losing the gene did. In fact, they did this cool experiment where they gave C4-treated cells extra ATP from the outside, and it partially rescued them. It confirmed that messing with energy production was a key part of how C4 worked.
So C4 dials down PLK1, messes with the energy supply, and triggers cell death. That sounds like exactly what you'd want. What was the clincher evidence in vivo?
Precisely. C4 treatment clearly reduced PLK1 protein levels in the cells, and it switched on apoptosis that programmed cell death. You could see the markers, like cleaved PARP. But most importantly, yes, giving C4 to the mice significantly suppressed tumor growth, both in the standard TNBC xenografts and in those really important HCI-010 PDX models. It really validates the therapeutic potential in living systems against tough tumor types.
This is really impressive work. It feels like a potential shift.
Yeah.
What does this all mean for how we might treat these PLK1-driven cancers in the future?
It offers a genuinely novel and, I think, very promising strategy, especially because, as we talked about, directly inhibiting PLK1 has been so challenging with all the side effects and limited efficacy. This indirect approach seems to sidestep some of those issues.
Yeah, it feels different, right?
Yeah.
Targeting IGF-2 BP2 instead of PLK1 directly.
It is fundamentally different. The way they found it, the systematic screening, the single cell analysis, the rigorous PDX validation that gives a lot of confidence in IGF-2 BP2 as a target, and the mechanism, the synergy, it's fascinating. It's not just turning down PLK1, it's simultaneously hitting the mitochondria, cutting off the energy supply by destabilizing those RXPHOS transcripts. That dual hit seems particularly powerful against cancer cells that are so dependent on high energy production to grow so fast. It's like pulling two critical fuses at once.
Okay, so compound C4 looks great as a proof of concept, but is it ready for clinical trials tomorrow? What needs to happen next?
Right, C4 is very promising as a prototype, but the researchers are clear it's not quite a finished drug yet. The concentrations needed for it to work are still relatively high, so more chemistry work is needed to make it more potent, effective at lower doses, and improve its bioavailability, how well it gets absorbed and reaches the tumor. And crucially, they need to do more work to confirm its specificity. Does it only hit IGF-2 BP2, or does it affect other similar RNA-binding proteins? Ruling out off-target effects is essential before you can safely test it in people. Those are key steps for clinical translation.
Makes sense. And what about those other hits from the screens? You mentioned CRB3, TGP3, DPP9. Are they still interesting? Could they be future targets too?
That's a really good point. The study definitely highlighted them as strong candidates as well. CRB3 and TGP3, they're involved in cell junctions, which might connect to PLK1's role in cell division, how cells physically separate. That's an interesting angle. DPP9 is a type of enzyme, a peptidase, and there's some suggestion it might link to mitotic entry, another key part of cell division. So absolutely, further research into these could uncover even more ways to target PLK1-driven cancers. Maybe some cancers rely more on one pathway than another, or maybe combination therapies. This study really built a fantastic framework for discovery, opening up several potential new avenues. But the core insight, the main takeaway right now, is that this protein, IGF-2BP2, it really represents a novel, druggable vulnerability in cancers that have too much PLK1.
So the bottom line, this research seems to have found a genuine Achilles heel for these aggressive cancers in IGF-2BP2. Targeting it gives you that powerful 1-2 punch, turning down a key cancer driver and starving the tumor of energy. It could be a way to finally get around drug resistance.
Exactly. This dual mechanism offers a really promising strategy. It could potentially overcome that heterogeneity problem and give us a new way to treat some really aggressive malignancies. It definitely raises the question, what does this mean for the future of precision cancer therapy, tailoring treatments to the specific weak spots of each tumor?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this analysis, the best way to support Base by Base is to subscribe or follow in your favorite podcast app and leave us a 5-star rating. It only takes a few seconds, but makes a huge difference in helping others discover the show. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, Base by Base.